This piece is called The Information War. Humanity has always invested heavily in any scheme that offers escape from the body. And why not? Material reality is such a mess. Some of the earliest religious artifacts, such as Neanderthal ochre burials, already suggest a belief in immortality. All modern, that is, all post-Paleolithic religions, contain the Gnostic trace of distrust or even outright hostility to the body and the created world. Contemporary primitive, so-called primitive tribes, and even peasant pagans, have a concept of immortality and of going outside the body, or literally in Greek, ekstasy, outside, standing outside the body. But these people maintain this idea without necessarily exhibiting any excessive body hatred. The Gnostic trace accumulates very gradually, like mercury poisoning, till eventually it turns pathological. Gnostic dualism, such as you find in the first century, exemplifies the extreme position of this disgust by shifting all value from body to spirit. This idea characterizes what we call civilization. A similar trajectory can be traced through the phenomenon of war. Now, hunter-gatherers practiced, and still practice, a kind of ritualized brawl rather than war. Real war, as we know it, classical war, is a continuation of religion and economics, that is, politics, by other means, and thus only begins historically with the priestly invention of scarcity in the Neolithic and the emergence of a warrior caste and a priest caste. I personally reject the theory that war is a prolongation of hunting. World War II seems to have been the last real war in this sense. Hyper-real war began in Vietnam with the involvement of television, and in 1991, hyper-real war reached its full obscene revelation in the Gulf War, or Nintendo War, as we called it in America. Hyper-real war is no longer economic. It is no longer the health of the state. The ritual brawl of the so-called primitive tribe is voluntary and non-hierarchic. The war chiefs are always temporary. After the war is over, they have no power. Real war, or classical war, is compulsory and hierarchic. Hyper-real war is imagistic and psychologically interiorized as pure war. In the first, the primitive war, the body is risked. In the second, classical warfare, the body is sacrificed. In the third, hyper-real war, the body has disappeared. Modern science also incorporates an anti-materialist bias, the dialectical outcome of its war against religion. Modern science has, in some sense, become religion. Science as knowledge of material reality paradoxically decomposes the materiality of the real. I'll read that again. Science as knowledge of material reality paradoxically decomposes the materiality of the real. Science has always been a species of priestcraft, a branch of cosmology, and an ideology, and a justification of the way things are. The deconstruction of the real, so-called, in post-classical physics, mirrors the vacuum of irreality, or unreality, which constitutes the state. Once the image of heaven on earth, the state now consists of no more than the management of images. It is no longer a force, but a disembodied patterning of information. In fact, I like to say that the modern state has simply become a flag carrier for corporate capitalism. All modern government is the Liberian government. You know, the little African state that gives a flag to various ships, you know, so you can smuggle everything under a nice legal flag. But just as the Babylonian cosmology justified Babylonian power, so too does the finality of modern science serve the ends of the terminal state, the post-nuclear state, the information state, or so the new paradigm would have us believe. And, of course, everyone accepts the axiomatic premises of this new paradigm. The new paradigm is very spiritual. Even the New Age, with its Gnostic tendencies, embraces the new science and its increasing etherealization as a source of proof texts for its spiritualist world view. Meditation and cybernetics go hand in hand. Of course, the information state somehow requires the support of a police force and a prison system that would have stunned Nebuchadnezzar and reduced all the priests of Moloch to paroxysms of awe. And modern science still can't weasel out of its complicity in the very nearly successful conquest of nature, civilization's greatest triumph over the body. But who cares? It's all relative, isn't it? I guess we'll just have to evolve beyond the body. Maybe we can do it in a quantum leap. Meanwhile, the excessive mediation of the social, which is carried out through the machinery of the media, increases the intensity of our alienation from the body by fixating the flow of attention on information rather than on direct experience. In this sense, the media serves a religious or priestly role, appearing to offer us a way out of the body by redefining spirit as information. The essence of information is the image, the sacral or sacred and iconic data complex which usurps the primacy of the material bodily principle as the vehicle of incarnation, replacing it with a fleshless ecstasy beyond corruption. Consciousness becomes something which can be downloaded, excised from the matrix of animality, and immortalized as information. No longer ghost in the machine, but the machine as ghost. Machine as Holy Ghost, ultimate mediator, which will translate us from our little corpses to a pleroma or a heaven of life. Virtual reality as cyber gnosis. Jack in, leave Mother Earth behind. All science proposes a paradigmatic universalism, by which I mean, as in science, so in the social. Classical physics played midwife to capitalism, communism, fascism, and all the other modern ideologies. So post-classical physics also proposes a set of ideas meant to be applied to the social. Relativity, quantum unreality, cybernetics, information theory, etc., etc. With some exceptions, the post-classical tendency is towards ever greater etherealization. Some proponents of black hole theory, for example, talk like pure Christian theologians, while some of the information theorists are beginning to sound like virtual Manichaeans. On the level of the social, these paradigms give rise to a rhetoric of bodilessness, which would be quite worthy of a 3rd-century desert monk or a 17th-century Puritan, but expressed in a language of post-industrial, post-modern, feel-good consumer frenzy. Our every conversation is infected with certain paradigmatic assumptions, which are really no more than bald assertions, but which we take for the very fabric, the very Urgrund of reality itself. For instance, since we now assume that computers represent a real step toward artificial intelligence, we also assume that buying a computer makes us more intelligent. In my own field, I've met dozens of writers who sincerely believe that owning a PC has made them better writers. Not more efficient, but better. This is amusing. But the same feeling about computers, when applied to a $1 trillion military budget, turns out Star Wars, killer robots, etc. And if you don't know the work of Manuel Galanda on the military aspects of artificial intelligence, his book is called War in the Age of Intelligent Machines. It hasn't been translated, I suppose. No, but it's out there in English anyway. An important part of this rhetoric about artificial intelligence involves the concept of an information economy. The post-industrial world is now thought to be giving birth to this new economy. One of the clearest examples of this concept can be found in a recent book by a man who is a libertarian, that means a right-wing capitalist anarchist, and also the bishop of a Gnostic dualist church in California, Bishop Heller, a very learned and respected writer, who says, "The industry of the past phase of civilization, sometimes called low technology, was big industry, and bigness always implies oppressiveness. The new high technology, however, is not big in the same way. While the old technology produced and distributed material resources, the new technology produces and disseminates information. The resources marketed in high technology are less about matter and more about mind. Under the impact of high technology, the world is moving increasingly from a physical economy into what might be called a metaphysical economy. We are in the process of recognizing that consciousness, rather than raw materials or physical resources, constitutes wealth." This modern neo-Gnosticism usually plays down the old dualist attack on the body and gives us a more gentle, green type of rhetoric. Bishop Heller, for instance, stresses the importance of ecology and environment because he says we don't want to foul our nest. We don't want to shit where we sleep. We don't want to ruin the earth because that's where we have to live, he says. But in his chapter on Native American spirituality, American Indian spirituality, he implies that a cult of the earth is clearly inferior to the pure Gnostic spirit of bodilessness. He says, quote, "But we must not forget that the nest," which he referred to, the nest which we don't want to foul, "we must not forget that the nest is not the same as the bird. The exoteric and esoteric traditions declare that Earth is not the only home for human beings, that we did not grow like weeds from the soil. While our bodies indeed may have originated on this Earth, our inner essence did not. To think otherwise puts us outside of all of the known spiritual traditions and separates us from the wisdom of the seers and sages of every age. Though wise in their own ways, Native Americans have small connection with this rich spiritual heritage." In such terms, which I read as the body equals the savage, the bishop's hatred and disdain for the flesh illuminate every page of his book. In his enthusiasm for a truly religious economy, he forgets that one cannot eat information. Real wealth can never become immaterial until humanity achieves the final etherealization of downloaded consciousness. Information in the form of culture can be called wealth, metaphorically, because it is useful and desirable, but it can never be wealth in precisely the same basic way that oysters and cream, or wheat and water, are wealth in themselves. Information is always only information about something. Like money, information is not the thing itself. Now, over time, we could come to think of money as wealth, but in truth, this is sloppy, abstract thinking. It has allowed its focus of attention to wander from the bun to the penny, which symbolizes the bun. And here I just yesterday came across a quote from Derek de Kerkova, who I think spoke here, or any rate at an event organized by Conrad. And I got another nice quote about information spirituality here. He says, "The ultimate goal, where is technology going? Its ultimate goal is to bridge mind and matter in real time. That is, to have no interface, no medium. The medium is the message, no more medium. Just direct thought to matter. All this is going on very fast right now. If you can translate every matter into 0-1 or into a digit, every texture, every substance, every sensory input or output, every display form, you are dealing with a complete etherealization of matter." The very phrase which I used in my paper before I read this, a complete etherealization of matter. "It's becoming co-substantial with mind by digitization. Digitization is one step beyond atomization. Atomization remains material. digitization is spiritual atomization. Very, very much the process of 2,000 years history. Instant distribution, the net, huge computers, 20 million co-processors. So we have instant communication everywhere, and that is another etherealization of form, and it is another transmutation of mind. Completely new associations of consciousness are going on. So that's another aspect of this transformation. So says Derek DeCherto. In effect, we have had an information economy ever since we invented money, but we still have not learned how to digest copper. The Aesopian crudity of these truisms embarrasses me, but I have to play the stupid, lazy yokel plowing a crooked furrow when all the straight thinkers around me appear to be hallucinating. Americans and other first world types seem particularly susceptible to the rhetoric of a metaphysical economy because we, Americans, can no longer see or feel or smell around us very much evidence of a physical world. Our architecture has become symbolic. We have enclosed ourselves in the manifestations of abstract thoughts, automobiles, apartments, offices, schools. We work at service or information-related jobs, helping in our little way to move disembodied symbols of wealth around an abstract grid of capital. And we spend our leisure largely engrossed in media rather than in direct experience of material reality. The material world for us has come to symbolize catastrophe, as in our amazingly hysterical reactions to storms and hurricanes. If you've ever been in America and watched American weather television, when there's a big storm on, it's like the devil himself, you know. This is the proof that we have failed to conquer nature. This is the worst thing we can imagine. Then there's our neo-Puritan fear of sexual otherness, or our taste for bland and denatured abstract food. And yet, this first world economy is not self-sufficient. It depends for its position, which is at the top of the pyramid, on a vast substructure of old-fashioned material production. Mexican farm workers grow and package all that natural organic food for us so we can devote our time to stocks, insurance, law, computers, video games. Peons in Taiwan make silicon chips for our PCs. Arabs in the Middle East suffer and die for our sins. Life? All our servants can do that for us. We have no life, only lifestyle. An abstraction of life based on the sacred symbolism of the commodity mediated by the priesthood of the stars, those larger-than-life abstractions who rule our values and people our dreams, the media archetypes, or perhaps mediarchs would be a better term. Of course, this Baudrillardian dystopia doesn't really exist yet. It's surprising, however, to note how many social radicals consider it a desirable goal, at least so long as it's called the information revolution or something equally trendy and inspiring. Leftists talk about seizing the means of information production away from the data monopolists. In truth, information is everywhere. Even atom bombs can be constructed on plans available in public libraries. This is true. It's been done. As Noam Chomsky points out, one can always access information, provided one has a private income and a fanaticism bordering on insanity. Universities and think tanks make pathetic attempts to monopolize information. They too are dazzled by the notion of an information economy, but their conspiracies are laughable. Information may not always be free, but there's a great deal more of it available than any one person could ever possibly use. Books on every conceivable subject can actually still be found in libraries. Meanwhile, someone still has to grow pears and cobble shoes, or even if those industries can be completely mechanized, someone still has to eat pears and wear shoes. The body is still the basis of wealth. The idea of images as wealth is a spectacular delusion. Even a radical critique of information can still give rise to an overvaluation of abstraction and data. And recently I saw a very, very radical post-situationist anarchist, Zine from England, The name of the publication is No, and the following message was written in handwriting, very messy handwriting, across the back cover of a recent issue. He says, this anonymous English anarchist says, as you read these words, the information age explodes inside and around you with the misinformation missiles and propaganda bombs of outright information warfare. Traditionally, war has been fought for territory, economic gain. Information wars are fought for the acquisition of territory indigenous to the information age, that is, the human mind itself. In particular, it is the faculty of the imagination that is under the direct threat of extinction from the onslaughts of multimedia overload. Danger! Your imagination may not be your own. As a culture sophisticates, it deepens its reliance on its images, icons, and symbols as a way of defining itself and communicating with other cultures. As the accumulating mix of a culture's images floats around in its collective psyche, certain isomorphic icons coalesce to produce and to project an illusion of reality. Fads, fashions, artistic trends, you know the score. I can take their images for reality because I believe in the reality of their images, or their image of reality. Whoever controls the metaphor governs the mind. The conditions of total saturation are slowly being realized. A creeping paralysis from the trivialization of special technical knowledge to the specialization of trivia. The information war is a war we cannot afford to lose. The result is unimaginable. Unquote. I find myself rather in sympathy with the author's critique of media here, and yet I also feel that a demonization of information has been proposed, which consists of nothing more than the mirror image of information as salvation. Again, Baudrillard's vision of the Comtech universe is invoked, but this time as hell rather than as the Gnostic heaven. Our bishop, our Gnostic bishop, wants everybody jacked in and downloaded. The anonymous post-situationist, the ranting anarchist, wants you to smash your television. But both of them believe in the mystical power of information. One, the bishop, proposes the Pax Technologica. The other, our anarchist comrade, declares war. But both exude a kind of Manichaean Gnostic view of good and evil. They just can't agree on which is which. Now, the critical theorist, by which I simply mean someone who feels critical about all this, the critical theorist swims in a sea of facts. We like to imagine it also as our maquis, you know, our underground, and with ourselves as the guerrilla ontologists of its datascape. Since the 19th century, the ever-mutating social sciences have unearthed a vast hoard of information on everything, from shamanism to semiotics. Each new discovery feeds back into social science and changes it. We drift. We fish for poetic facts, data which will intensify and mutate our experience of the real. We invent new hybrid sciences as tools for this process. Ethnopharmacology, ethnohistory, cognitive studies, history of ideas, subjective anthropology, that's anthropological poetics or ethnopoetics, Dada epistemology, etc., etc. We look on all this knowledge not as good in itself, but valuable only inasmuch as it helps us to seize or to construct our own happiness. In this sense, we do know of information as wealth. Nevertheless, we continue to desire wealth itself and not merely its abstract representation in or as information. At the same time, we also know of information as war. Nevertheless, we have not decided to embrace ignorance just because facts can be used like a poison gas. Ignorance is not even an adequate defense much less a useful weapon in this war. We attempt neither to fetishize nor to demonize information. Instead, we try to establish a set of values by which information can be measured and assessed. Our standard in this process can only be the human body. Now, according to certain mystics, such as Jakob Burma, for example, spirit and body are one. Now, certainly spirit has lost its ontological solidity, since Nietzsche anyway, while the body's claim to reality has been undermined by modern science to the point of vanishing in a cloud of pure energy. So, why not assume that spirit and body are one, after all, and that they are twin aspects of the same underlying and inexpressible real, in quotes. No body without spirit, no spirit without body. The Gnostic dualists are wrong, and the vulgar dialectical materialists are wrong. Body and spirit together make life. If either pole is missing, the result is death. Now, this constitutes a fairly simple set of values, assuming we prefer life to death. Obviously, I am avoiding any strict definitions of body or spirit or reality or any of these terms. I'm speaking of so-called empirical everyday experiences. We experience spirit when we dream or when we create. We experience body when we eat or shit, or maybe it's the other way around. We experience both at once when we make love. I'm not proposing metaphysical categories here. We're still drifting, and these are ad hoc points of reference. We need only point out that no other reality has yet appeared within the context of our knowable experience. For all practical purposes, the world is one. Historically, however, the body half of this unity has always received the insult, the bad press, the scriptural condemnation, and the economic persecution of the spirit half. The self-appointed representatives of the spirit have called almost all the tunes in known history, leaving the body only a prehistory of primitive disappearance and a few spasms of failed insurrectionary futility. Spirit has ruled. Hence, we scarcely even know how to speak the language of the body. When we use the word information, we reify it, because we have always reified abstractions, ever since God appeared as a burning bush. By the way, God is burning bush equals, I think, information is the catastrophic decorporealization of brute matter. We would now like to propose the identification of self with body. We're not denying that the body is also spirit, but we wish to restore some balance to the historical equation. We calculate all body hatred and world slander as our evil. We insist on the revival and the mutation of pagan values concerning the relation of body and spirit. We fail to feel any great enthusiasm for the information economy because we see it as yet another mask for body hatred. We can't quite believe in the information war since it also hypostatizes information but labels it evil. In this sense, information would appear to be neutral, but we also distrust this third position as a lukewarm cop-out and a failure of theoretical vision. Every so-called fact takes different meanings as we run it through our dialectical prism and study its gleam and shadows. The fact is never inert or neutral, but it can be both good and evil, or beyond them, in countless variations and combinations. We, finally, are the artists of this immeasurable discourse. We create values. We do this because we're alive. Information is as big a mess as the material world it reflects and transforms. We embrace the mess, all of it. It's all life. But within the vast chaos of the alive, certain information and certain material things begin to coalesce into a poetics, or a way of knowing, or a way of acting. We can draw certain temporary conclusions as long as we don't plaster them over and set them up on altars. Neither information, nor indeed any one fact, constitutes a thing in itself. The very word information implies an ideology, or rather a paradigm, rooted in an unconscious fear of the silence of matter and of the universe. Information is a substitute for certainty, a leftover fetish of dogmatics, a superstitio, literally in Latin, a spook, a ghost. Poetic facts are not assimilable to the doctrine of information. Knowledge is freedom. This slogan is true only when freedom is understood as a psychokinetic skill. Freedom is a psychokinetic skill. Information is a chaos. Knowledge is the spontaneous ordering of that chaos, and freedom is surfing the wave of that spontaneity. Thank you.